kind of went through a construction to write 3D gravity in terms of different variables, so not using the metric, but introducing these triads, which essentially give you an orthonormal frame. In doing this, we had a residual SO3 gauge freedom, so that essentially means that this orthonormal frame, you have an additional rotational symmetry in that frame. And then when we did this, we had to introduce a covariant derivative that described how this frame changed as we went from different positions. And that was in terms of this spin connection, which essentially does the same thing as the affine connection does for vectors, but for the triad, the orthonormal frame. Now, we also demanded this compatibility condition, which essentially means that the covariant derivative acting on these internal indices, which are the indices of the frame, is essentially parallel transported along the manifold. And if we demand this condition, that means that the spin connection is completely determined by our old covariant derivative, so our old connection. In the case that we demand metricity, so the metric, it doesn't change with the covariant derivative, this means that our spin connection is anti-symmetric on these last two indices. After doing that, we sort of looked at the curvature tensor and found that we could write the Riemann tensor in this orthonormal frame in terms of the spin connection. So and this had a very similar structure to what we had with the connection in ordinary gravity. So derivative of the connection plus product of the connection. Now in 3D, there's a kind of a special thing that you can take any anti-symmetric object and write it as essentially the totally anti-symmetric tensor contracted with an object that carries all the information of our original object. So this is particularly nice because it means that we can very easily see that this spin connection that we've defined is an SU2 value connection. So let's look at the covariant derivative on some object that carries an internal index. And then that's d mu. Something like that, I'm not quite sure about the indices. Anyway, these are the structure constants of SU2, so this is exactly how covariant derivatives act for what we're used to with gauge theories in particle physics. And then after introducing all these objects, we sort of rewrote the action. So this just has a tilde on it to remind us that it's a tensor density, which essentially means that this measure is also invariant. And this is our triad, and this is our curvature tensor. So varying this action with respect to the triad and the connection leads to two equations of motion. One of them is that the curvature tensor is zero, which is what we got before, and the other one is that the torsion is zero. So that's a crucial point, because in this construction, we're not a priori demanding that torsion is zero. So I guess that when we go to quantum stuff, we might see that torsion plays a role. Then we kind of fixed our gauge, which amounted to sort of picking a time slice and a spatial manifold. And then we rewrote this action and found that we had two constraints and one action part, and then we found some canonical variables from that. So I'll just rewrite this up. So this was the flatness constraint, and this was the Gauss constraint, and we saw that these two here are just Lagrange multipliers, and then our canonical variables were A, and this E, but this was just coming from varying the action with respect to the time derivative of A, and A we had relabeled our connection. So omega went to A, and we had this canonical Poisson bracket that I assume we're going to go through the steps to quantize.
Question on this part? So today we're going to look in details, more in details about what is the interpretation of this constraint. Okay, and first I want to come back on the symmetries of this action, because so what are the symmetries of this action we mentioned already? So we have the diffeomorphisms, and since we are using the triad here, we also have the internal rotation. Okay, but in fact, there is an additional symmetry here, which is a translation symmetry. So I'm going to mention that, and we're going to see that these three symmetries are not independent. And what makes 3D gravity so simple is that you can in fact replace the diffeomorphism symmetry by your translation symmetry, which is of course much easier to deal with. So this is what we're going to see, and see what are the interpretation of this constraint. We need to check, of course, that this constraint are, if they are first class or second class. Okay, here we have all the constraints. There is no additional secondary or tertiary constraint, but are they first class or second class? So we're going to check that. And then we will start the Dirac quantization program. Okay, and in fact, we're going to spend some time on the first step to define, before going to the kinematical Hilbert space, we will have to think about what are the good function phase space functions that we can use. Because in fact, we need it's not going to be as simple as the parameterized particle, where we didn't have so many options. But here, so let's move this Okay, so what are the symmetry? So my actions, I'm going to renormalize a bit the actions. So I'm going, my starting point is this one. And at some point, I'm going to use more form notation. But for the moment, let's keep this one. So this is my action. What are the symmetries? So since we introduced triad, we have this rotation. Or let's call internal rotation. And during the tutorial tomorrow, you're going to work on this symmetry and see what are the variation of the variable under an internal rotation. Then we have DFO, but more surprising, something maybe we were not expecting. We have an additional one, which is a translation symmetry. So let's see together what does it mean here. So it's going to be a symmetry which only affects the triad. Okay, it's not going to, it's not affecting at all the connection. And it's just parameterized by a scalar field with one internal index. So indeed, if you check, if you look at this variation, so it's going to be parameterized by one scalar. At the variation with respect, so this is because T is just for translation, N is the scalar parametrizing here my symmetry. So I'm looking at this variation here, okay? And for a translation, the variation on the translation is on the connection is zero. And here it's just what we're expecting. And indeed, so how do you see that this action is invariant under this transformation? So here, if now you replace your triad just by this term, okay? And so what you're going to get? You're going to get d mu nj times this, the curvature tensor field, okay? And so now you can do an integration by part. And so you're going to get, so if you replacing in the action plus doing an integration by part, what you're going to get? You're going to get the covariant derivative of your curvature tensor. And this, in fact, is, so maybe you're more familiar with the Bianchi identity written in terms of the Riemann tensor, but here it's exactly is zero because it's okay, so this shows that indeed your action is invariant under translation. So in the tutorial, you're going to look at these two transformation symmetries, in particular the internal rotation, and you're going to, starting from a finite rotation, what are the transformations for these two fields at the infinitesimal level? Okay. So any questions here on this?
What's this T label?
Sorry, here? The T?
Yeah.
So this is just for the meaning that I'm looking at the translation symmetry, which is parameterized by So the translation is parameterized by this scalar. So it's a scalar n with an internal index. Okay, so I'm going to use here, when you're going to compute, in the tutorial you will compute what are the variation of the field associated to a rotation, and then your rotation usually is going to be parameterized by a vector, which can be, so it's going to be the norm of this vector is going to give the angle, and this is the direction, the axis of your rotation. And so you're also going to compute this object. I'm going to be 0. And for the DFAO, so we're also going to have something in terms of so it's going to be characterized by another vector, n mu, v mu. And I'm going to come back on this, in fact, because as I said, these symmetries are not independent, and we're going to see what this means here. But maybe first, should I do that now? No, let's first look at the canonical analysis of this and what are the interpretations of this constraint. Because in fact, so what we're going to see is that, so we have two constraints, two kinds of constraints. So the Gauss constraint is going to generate the internal rotation, and the flatness constraint, so with the F here, is going to generate the translation symmetry. So in fact, indeed, we are not going to deal with, at any time, with diffeomorphism symmetry. So what does it mean? So we are going to show that indeed you can, these symmetries are not independent, and you can express the DFAO symmetry in terms of these two, at least on shell, okay? Meaning when the equation of motion are satisfied. Okay, so any question on that? Now? Okay. So let's. Okay, so with the Hamiltonian formulation, so Finn gave the expression here. So we have one canonical pair, one, it's more than one, because here, so J can take three values, and A can take it. So now A and B are spatial coordinates, okay? So this means that it's the value 1, 2. And J are still the SU2 labels here. Okay, and all the other Poisson brackets are going to vanish. Okay, so between A and EE, or with the E0, are going to vanish. So did you give, yeah, so let me write explicitly what is. So we're going to define the flatness constraint is just and so this is the flatness. And the Gauss constraint where here you see that we have the torsion. So again, this constraint appear here as equation of motion when you vary the action with respect to the Lagrange multiplier. But you see that they are need to be interpreted as as constraint, because you don't have the time derivative here, any time derivative here. Okay, so it's not really an equation of motion, it's more a constraint. So this is the flatness constraint, and this is the Gauss constraint. Let me write explicitly because we're going to use this expression. In terms, so this is just a function of the connection, so it's independent of the triad. And me, and epsilon. And what is now the Hamiltonian of for gravity? So as is any diffeomorphism invariant system, it's a totally constrained system because you can see that. So here, by analogy to the what you used to in classical mechanics, when you have p q dot plus h, okay. So here you can interpret the h part as it's a sum of the constraint, and here by sum I also mean that we take into account that we have an integration. Where here I introduce this to Lagrange multiplier. Okay, Lagrange multiplier, instead of using this notation, these are just function on phase space, so I'm just introducing this to Lagrange multiplier here, okay? So this is the Hamiltonian, and so you have a totally constrained system here, which is really a feature that you would get in any system which are diffeo invariant. So now what are the interpretation of this constraint? Yeah, I introduced a curly F, so I guess it has to be a curly F. Thanks. So, to look at the interpretation of the constraint, what I want to compute is the flow of the constraint, okay, for each, the flow of the each phase space function of these two phase space function by the constraint. But you see that here, in fact, we are going to define, we want to regularize this constraint, because if we look at just the Poisson bracket between this constraint and the variable here, we're going to end up with delta function. And since at the end we want to quantize things, we want to get rid of this delta function, so we're going to first regularize this constraint. And the way to regularize this constraint is to smear this constraint. So we're going to use here the fact that this has to be valid for any Lagrange multiplier, and we're going to define the smeared constraint. As well, now we integrate over all possible. And this is defined for all choices of lambda. And we have the smeared flatness constraint, which is defined as this constraint are much better defined than the point-wise constraint. And now we can look at the infinitesimal changes associated to the Gauss constraint and flatness constraint for the phase space variable. Okay, so let's compute this now. Yeah.
Can you just explain how you get this Hamiltonian from?
Yeah. So here it's. Okay. So this is. So we interpret this as our configuration variable. Okay, we have a derivative of the configuration variable here. So here, this is going to be the associated conjugate variables that Finn just defined here. So this densitized triad here is epsilon AB times EB. OK, so here the term you have here is exactly Q dot P. OK, and then when you rewrite your Lagrangian, OK, when you go from the Lagrangian to the Hamiltonian formalism, then you interpret here. So this has to be what you call your Hamiltonian here. OK, so this is more by analogy to what you know, how you can read that from this, so just this section.
J and lambda J are just what we see in the two last terms.
Yeah, so here these are Lagrange multiplier. OK, and we are dealing with, so they are not dynamical variable, but they are function on the phase space. Okay, so here instead of using this heavy notation, because there is no, at this point there is really no relation between. Of course, you do this 2 plus 1 splitting in this case, but then these variables here are not dynamical. Okay, so they are really Lagrange multipliers, so you can just call them the way you want. So I'm just using the more used notation where usually you have this Laplace function and here the Gauss constraint is. So it's just.
Also, Nj is just like epsilon, E or J and A.
So these are the Lagrange multipliers. This is Nj. OK, and this is the Gauss one. OK, so here you really have that this is. So yeah, this is good to rewrite. So it's dt, and then you have this integration. OK, so we keep the dt, but this is like another summation. And here you have this. Aj, and then the derivative of plus. So I'm just calling okay, so this is really just the way you read your, just reading your action. Okay, so let's look at the infinitesimal change. So I'm just going to give you here the result for the rotation because you're going to do that explicitly. I think it's better if you try to do it explicitly yourself. So you're going to do that in the tutorial and see that indeed this is really a rotation. So associated first to the Gauss constraint. For the phase space variable. So now I'm going to look at the variation. It's going to be given by this parameter lambda. And what I need to compute is this Poisson bracket, where here now I'm using the smeared variable just because it's the definition, it's well defined. And so I'm just going to, so here you need, of course, to use the fact that these two variables are conjugated. OK, so here, where is the G? So you see that for G, you're going to, the only term which is going to contribute is this one, OK? Because so E with E is going to be 0, and E with E also is not going to contribute. So the only contribution comes from the Poisson bracket with, so your densitized triad with this term here. Okay? And this is going to give you a delta. But since you have an integration now, OK, at the end, you don't get delta. You just get just a function here. You use your integration to get rid of the delta function. So this is why we're using this smeared variable. And also in the tutorial tomorrow, you're going to check that indeed, if you look at the variation, at the variation of densitized triad by acting with an infinitesimal rotation, you're really going to get that. Where here, what is the interpretation of this lambda? The interpretation of this lambda is going to be that lambda k is going to be the axis of your rotation, and the angle of your rotation is going to be given by the norm of this lambda. Okay, so this lambda can really here characterize a rotation, and the transformation, the Gauss constraint, is going to act really as an infinitesimal rotation on your densitized triad. And you can check the same thing with, so I'm just writing the result because I'm going to use it when we're going to look at the constraint algebra. So I need to have the expression, but really it's good that you try to do this calculation by yourself to see why it's interesting to work with smeared constraint here, and that at the end, indeed, you don't get any delta function. And okay, evaluated in x here. So we're here, it's again the lambda. And so here, if now you look at f, okay, and so the Poisson bracket I'm still looking at the Gauss constraint. So here now it's A with this term. So you see that this term is going to, this one is going to contribute, but you need to do an integration by part to get, to remove the integration on the E variable. And then this term is also going to contribute. So you see that the derivative here is going to come from the fact that you need to do an integration by part here to get the Poisson bracket between A and E, okay? So, and again, if you look at now our rotation will transform your connection, an infinitesimal rotation, you would get exactly this result. So really what we say is that the Gauss constraint generate internal rotation. And now, what are the infinitesimal changes associated to the flatness constraint? So let's look at this, because this is really where we're going to see that indeed in 3D, we don't really need to care about the diffeomorphism in symmetry, because here, so now infinitesimal. Changes associated to flatness constraints. So what are we going to? So again, we need to compute this. So now it's going to depend on this parameter n. And we compute the variation of the densitized triad by looking at the Poisson bracket between. And again, so here now F. So which one is going to be easy? So this one, we need to do some computation, so we can do it if you want together. But if you now look at this one, so I'm going to write the result. So this one is very easy. What do you get here? If you look at the variation of the connection by the flatness constraint. So the flatness is here. And the only non-zero Poisson bracket is this one.
Zero.
Yeah. Okay, very good, because the flatness constraint is just a function of the connection. Okay, so the connection with just a function of the connection, of course, is going to be zero. And if you remember, it's what we, when I define here the action of a translation on the connection, it's what you expect, you get zero, okay? So this is nice. And now, if we compute now the Poisson bracket between E and F here, so you see that, again, we need to do an integration by part for this first term, where we're going to get an integration over N. And yeah, so here, so Philippe or Sharon, you should be, I did a mistake here, no? It's the variation of, yeah, I think it should be. Because how do you get this? So, okay, maybe we're going to do explicitly this one, okay, together. And then you're going to see, but here, you don't want, so as I said, we need to do an integration by part, but then the A term is going to vanish because it's going to, we're not going to see it because it's just the Poisson bracket is going to give a delta. So here, when we do the integration by part go on the lambda, okay? Sorry about that. So let's try to do this one together. And of course, I don't have any lecture note on that, so you will have to help me here. So I guess you shouldn't. Okay, so usually it's not a very good idea to try to do a calculation on the blackboard when you haven't tried to do it like 5 minutes before on your paper, but let's, since you're here, you need to help me, okay? Out. With you guys, I'm sure I will be able to do it. Okay, so let's look at this. Poisson bracket where? Now let's try explicitly what is F. So I'm integrating over space, and I have a lambda. Let's choose another name because it's going to be summed. And then I want fk. Okay. Epsilon bc bac of k plus 1/2 of epsilon k m l. And then I need b c. Okay, so this is the Poisson bracket we want to compute, and the only non-zero is between a and e. Okay, so I need to here to do an integration by part to get a E with A for the first term, okay?
Where did the lambda come from?
Sorry?
Where did the lambda come from?
Maybe it's N, no?
N.
Yeah, thanks. Good point, so first mistake, thanks. Okay, so we're going to do an integration by part. So we're going to get a minus derivative of N, and then we get the E with A, okay? So here we get, the first Poisson bracket we get is aj, and we're going to get some akc. So this is also going to give us a minus, and then it's going to give us a delta x. So here also it should be y, and here it's a function of x. Okay, so what do we get? So here we get x, and this is a function of y. But we integrate over y, so the delta is also going to be removed. Okay, so we get nk, and we still have the epsilon bc, and from this Poisson bracket, we get a delta ac and a delta kj, and the delta xy is already been removed by the integration over y, okay? So this is just a function of x. So this is the first term. Then the second term, so now we have two contributions. We have this a and this a, OK? So let's do it. So maybe let's write explicitly what we get. So let's keep the integration. C plus times 1 half epsilon k m l. And now we have two terms. OK, so we first have the Poisson bracket between a k y and a m b of y times, so this one, LC of y, plus AMB of y, and then the Poisson bracket of E okay, so this is going to give us,
why do you get, you have E, K, J, and not A, J?
Why, you're telling me that it's, yeah, it's A here. A and A. Any other? So K, K, B, C, okay, and then M, L. So this should be fine now. Is that correct? So here we get a delta, so it's a minus. So delta AB, delta KM, and the delta XY. The delta XY is always going to be removed from the integration. And here we get AC LG. Okay, so can we simplify this? So we get epsilon dc plus, so 1/2 of m is equal to j here. So I should get nk epsilon. So b is equal to a, so ac. Epsilon k m is equal to j, so j l time minus, so a is equal to c. And now L is equal to J. J, M, J, and I have M, B. Sorry, this is like here. Okay, so this should be twice the same term. Is that correct? Or?
Just write it.
Yeah.
The first term has like two delta that we don't use.
Okay, yeah. So here it's J, right? And here it's A. Thanks. Coming from these two delta. Okay, so any. So here you should get the two same term. So this is some, so you can call this B. And here, instead of L, I can call it M. So instead of L, I call it M. And then indeed, I get KJM. So it's minus, but also it's minus here. So it's the same two terms. Okay. So here, indeed, I get what I was expecting, meaning that here, BA times the derivative the covariant derivative of Ng.
Did you say you did use the delta function for the integration?
Yeah, this one.
Yeah.
So okay. So here it's a function of x now. So what is your?
So it's like, in this case, it's like d squared y, but whatever like canonical relations, it would be like the dimension required for the delta function.
I'm not sure.
It's a two-dimensional delta function.
Yeah.
For x and y.
Sorry. Yeah. Okay. Okay, I get your question. So yeah, it's a dimension of, and here this comes from, the dimension you have here needs to be, it's the dimension of your paper surface here. And you see that it's the same in the definition of H. It's the same. You still have these two equations. Okay, so this shows that indeed the infinitesimal change is associated to the flatness constraint is the same thing that you would get if you would perform an infinitesimal translation on this field. Okay, so here what we conclude is that indeed translation flatness generate translation. So where are our diffeo symmetry here? We were expecting some diffeo symmetry, but so we have two kinds of constraints, the Gauss constraint and the flatness constraint. The Gauss constraint generates the rotation, and the flatness generates the translation. But indeed, also a priori, when you, before writing, looking carefully at this action, we were expecting only the diffeo and the internal rotation coming from the fact that we move from the metric formulation to the triad formulation. But we have shown that indeed we have this additional action, additional symmetry. So now, what is the relation between this symmetry? Keep this expression. And indeed, the point is that these symmetries are not independent. But it's also the fact that here we won't have to deal with diffeo is also what makes that 3D gravity is so simple. Okay, we can, in fact, we're just going to deal with a constraint generated a very simple symmetry, which is a translation symmetry. Okay, so let's first look at where are the diffeo here? Let's just clarify this, and then we will go to the constraint algebra. But first, let's try to clarify where are the diffeo. So first, let's look at the infinitesimal changes of our fields under diffeomorphism. And you know that by definition, an infinitesimal diffeo can be expressed in terms of the Lie derivative. So if this is not, if you're not so familiar with that, let me know and I will add a question on that in the tutorial tomorrow that you can review that. If it's very clear for everyone, I don't need to do it. So here, this just means that you have so here I'm not looking at the density-type triad, but just the triad. It's sufficient for the moment. But you know the relation between the two fields. So this is for the triad and for the connection. So the D here is for diffeomorphism. And we parameterize this with a vector field V. Okay, and we look at the infinitesimal transformation of this field under a diffeo And now, as an exercise, you can, as a first exercise, you can check that indeed the action is invariant under this transformation, meaning that if you replace the E and the A here in your action by this infinitesimal transformation, you should get zero. And again, so what you should notice here is that really the Lie derivative takes into account only transformation under space-time diffeomorphism. And here, with this transformation, the internal structure is really totally ignored. Okay, we don't take it into account. So where is the diffeomorphism hidden here in this formalism? So the symmetry are not independent on shell. And indeed, you can compute that if you look at the variation of some of your field under rotation and under translation with some well-defined parameter. So here for the rotation, I'm going to introduce this omega of v and E of v here for the, you can show that indeed this is, can be written as a transformation by diffeo, parametrized by this vector field v, plus a term which depends on the torsion field. So let me just write what is this vector. So is the rotation parameter and is just like this. And E of V is the translation parameter, where here we use the connection and here we use so the triad. So sorry, it should be an A here. I'm using A now. And so what does it mean? And you can check the same thing for A. Okay, you will get that the transformation under diffeo of A can be written as a transformation by rotation and a transformation under translation plus a term. And what is this term? So what is important is that this term is equal to zero on shell, which means that it's equal to zero when the equation of motion are satisfied. And you would get, if you compute the same thing for A here, you replace E by A, you would get the same expression, except that here what you get is the curvature tensor. Okay? So again, this is are equal when this is zero. So what does it mean? This means that on shell, so here what we conclude is that the symmetry are not independent on shell. Okay, and so what does it mean more carefully is that indeed, if we don't, here we're going to impose some constraints which are like generating rotation and translation, but on shell, it's like if we have been taken into account the diffeo symmetry. Okay, so I just want to finish on that quickly on the, I'm just going to give you the result of the constraint algebra, and then tomorrow like this, we can start the Dirac program, okay? So why do we need to look at the constraint algebra? If you remember, we want to check. So we have all our constraints now, but we need to check if these constraints are first class or second class, okay? And in particular, what it's going to tell us is that if they are first class, this means that the constraint surface is indeed preserved by our constraint. So everything is going to be, and we need to check that, okay? We need to check if the constraint surface is preserved by our symmetry, by our constraint here. So I'm just going to give you the result because, and then tomorrow we'll see if if you want me to do one of these calculations, or if you know how to do it, or maybe I can also add this to your tutorial, but your tutorial started to be a bit long. So I also want you to work on holonomies that I'm going to introduce tomorrow. So yeah, we'll see. I still need to. But this, some of these calculations are interesting. So this means that we want to look at the Poisson bracket between one constraint and all the others. So let's first start with the Gauss constraint defined for a given lambda with another Gauss constraint defined with lambda. And what does it mean that we want to have first class constraints? This means that this constraint algebra, so meaning looking at all the Poisson bracket between all constraints, has to be closed. They have to form an algebra. This means that all of this here, what I'm going to write here, can be written in terms of either the Gauss constraint or the flatness constraint. And if this is the case, this means that indeed this is closed, and these constraints are first class, because on shell, these Poisson brackets are zero, okay? Since it's going to be written in terms of Poisson bracket. So what is the result here? What you get here, if we do explicitly the calculation, is that this can be written in terms of a Gauss constraint, where now the parameter for this constraint is going to be given by the commutator between these two objects. And so what does it mean here? This means that here, lambda, okay, when there is no index, and I'm going to introduce this tomorrow, it means that I can define it as a Lie algebra valued object. Okay, so what I'm defining here, this is this object where here, this T are the SU2 or SO3 generators. And so you see that here, what we are going to recover is that indeed, this is really the commutator defining the SU2 algebra. And this is so this is what we were expecting, since we know that Gauss constraint is going to generate SU2 rotation, okay, SU2 transformation. So let me just finish with the result, and then, so by here, let me maybe just finish what this means. So this means that here I have and so of course these are just number, so this can go outside, but these are now the commutator between the SU2 generator, and this is really a commutator. So this means that this is just epsilon jk . And now, if you look at a translation with the generator of a translation with the generator of a rotation, what you get is just a translation where the translation parameter has been rotated by the rotation. Okay? So here you can see that, because here you're going to get, again, this commutator. So this just means here that the parameter of your translation is rotated by your rotation. And of course, you're expecting that two translation Poisson, the Poisson bracket between two is zero. And so the constraint algebra is closed, and even it mirrors the algebra R3, where the generator of R3 are the translation generator. And then you have this strange symbol to say that, so SO3 or SU2 here. Meaning that here, if you look at an element of this group, which can be decomposed as so a translation and a rotation, then you look at the product rule This means that the rotation is going to act non-trivially on this section. But I'm going to come back on that maybe tomorrow.